So thank you to Jason, Pierre, and the audience. Great presentations and great sort of enlightening aspects to think about as far as this topic. So now we'll go into the Q&A session, which Wendy will moderate for us.
Great. Thanks, Victoria. So the first question is for Jason. And the question is, the graph showing the correlation between temperature and excess mortality seems to show a lag between the high temperature event and mortality. Could you please explain a bit more?
Yeah, a number of studies have examined sort of the lag effect that temperature shows. We've been investigating that as well in the Madison area, like I mentioned, the study we're doing with hospital admissions. The lag that we found for zip code level temperature differences tends to be longer for lower temperatures, and as the temperatures get higher, like these extreme heat events, the lag is less. But it's sort of important to realize that the minimum temperature elevations that the heat island causes really is crucial for extending the time of exposure. So that's, I think, one reason that you see the lag, is that sure, high temperatures for, say, an hour will really only impact the most vulnerable people. But if you have high temperatures for a week, and especially in urban areas when you don't see the temperature go below, say, 85 degrees, even at night for a week, the exposure to those high temperatures is much longer. And so you start to see more and more people as that exposure gets longer and longer and longer. More people susceptible or sort of manifest the heat illness outcomes, heat outcomes.
Great. Thank you, Jason. So the next question is, I believe, for Pierre. And the question is, which component would show the most bang for the buck so that we could pilot a specific project to show a quick return on investment?
Well, there was one slide from Jason about that that said try to avoid cut the remaining forests and parks that are in town. That's number one, and that's in itself difficult. It needs a lot of organized groups to do that. The next thing would be, from my point of view, probably going for better management of water in town. So if you've got land where that water can remain, it's very effective in evaporating the energy accumulated in the soil. After that, I would say, of course, fighting parkings and cars, in the sense that you can promote bicycle paths and walking paths in town. And that can be brought through public transit. And every time you have one bus, it's usually the equivalent of 50 cars. So you can reduce the trees, not the trees, but the size of streets. And these are difficult, depending on what you define as a buck. There are some political bucks that are tough to implement. Others are easier. So it depends on the context. But of course, it's beginning to be a serious problem. It's going to get only worse, and eventually nothing can be solved only by air conditioning. I mean, there are several studies showing that it actually increases when it's generalized. It increased the heat in the city by several degrees, and not to mention power outages and several problems that can be linked to that. There's no simple answer to that. I believe a combination, our most effective projects have been a combination of planting trees, ripping off asphalt, and white roofs. that kind of stuff done together on, in a specific area.
Great. Thank you, Pierre. So the next question is for Victoria. And the question is, can green roofs also help moderate temperature? Your short slide just mentioned improved comfort and stormwater management. By comfort, did you mean temperature, aesthetic?
Great question. I forgot to mention that all of the mitigation strategies on the slide, green roofs, cool pavement, trees, and smart growth, do reduce temperatures. Whether they reduce surface or air temperatures depends on the mitigation strategy and other factors, but they all do reduce temperature and in the surrounding area around the buildings. The additional benefits that I mentioned were sort of some of the different ones that aren't as commonly thought of. But in addition to temperature increase, all of the mitigation strategies have been shown to also save on energy use, which can often reduce cost, and they have reduced air pollution, reduced greenhouse gases. There are some studies on these aspects, temperature decreases and other things, so I'm happy to point you to some if you'll send me an email. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Victoria. So next we have another question for Jason. And the question is, can you give a little more detail about the hot block, cool block slide? What's the actual temperature difference? Is it surface temperature or air temperature? I'm interested in a little bit more detail on that hot block, cool block comparison.
Yeah, like I said, that's very preliminary. It's sort of an anecdote that we've uncovered from a larger part of my PhD work. And so we're just beginning to sort of dive into that. But I will say that we were using the satellite imagery to sort of approximate temperatures. And so when I mentioned the sort of 7-degree difference between the two, that's a difference in land surface temperature, which, as I mentioned, is not always well correlated with air temperature. And that's one benefit of the network in Madison that we have, is that these sensors actually measure the air temperature, which is the metric that determines your exposure and the metric that is used in all the epidemiological studies. So that it's the metric that we know is associated with the health impacts.
Great, thank you. So next we have another question for Pierre. And the question is, or the participant wanted to know where they could find the complete life cycle assessment.
Well, if you it's on the web on our institute website. Just type in Google the title. The presentation will be made public, I believe, Victoria.
Yes, it will.
Okay, so just type the full title and you will find it easily.
Great, thank you. We'll do another question for Jason. Do rooftop solar panels respond more like cool roofs or hot roofs where albedo is concerned?
That's not something I know a lot about. So let me start my rambling with that disclaimer. I would like to see if Victoria, have you uncovered anything in the compendium of strategies that talked about that?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. When we know that we haven't covered that in our compendium, but I do know that several cities have when they have incentive programs for cool roofs or even laws that require cool roofs, some of them do allow credit for putting solar panels on the roof, meaning they don't have to install, have a cool roof per se on that section. So I'd be happy to maybe talk to some of those groups and find out if they've looked into it. It would seem to me to be a very technical question that would require some good academic research, which, we haven't done that at EPA.
Great, thanks. So I'm going to do another question for Pierre. And the question is, does the rainwater harvesting help by promoting vegetation growth, or is there some other impact?
Rainwater, what actually happens when it's in the soil after the it gets there, and when heat accumulates in the soil, it can evaporate and then bring accumulated energy to the atmosphere. One of the things after this first step of evaporation, the water that has been incorporated into trees and vegetation in the next days and the following days also evaporates, but through the leaves of the tree. So it contributes also to evacuating some of the accumulated energy. So that's the way it works. There are even some cities in Europe that I know that during heat waves use that rainwater that they've put in reservoirs on the streets. They just basically sprinkle the streets to decrease, to evacuate the energy. And so that's the way it works, a simple way of using basic physics.
Great, thank you. Next, we're going to ask a question for Victoria. The question is, how is the EPA state and local climate and energy program connecting with local public health departments, if at all?
Great question. I think we're connecting with them through this work that we've done to produce the webcast series. I think in general, in the Heat Island realm, those two groups, environmental and EPA and the public health agencies, have started to connect. In the past, they're connecting more and more. We do have relationships with the CDC, the American Public Health Association. With CDC, different parts of EPA have done research on the connection between climate change and health. And also with other groups like the American Public Health Association, we work as partners in just understanding each other's work and helping to promote each other's work. But in general, I would say we hope to do more collaboration with that realm, and I think this webcast series is a great way to kick that off.
Great, thanks. Now, we have a few questions for multiple speakers. So the first question is for both Jason and Pierre. And the question is, what does a speaker out of Atlanta, Jason, think of the last speaker's thoughts on the negative co-benefits of green roofs? So I guess it's for Jason.
Pierre, can you just describe some of those negative co-benefits quickly?
Yes, well, you have to read it. It's very dependent on where you are, what is your usual climate, and what kind of stuff you need to do to improve your act regarding urban heat island. What we did is for Montreal to take into account that context and see for each of these activities what was the impact in terms of production of greenhouse gases, any air pollutants that you will bring with your project. So you can imagine that developing a very intensive green roof on an existing building somewhere probably means that if you're in a densely inhabited neighborhood, that you'll need a big truck bringing soil. You'll need, to import from somewhere the trees or any vegetation that you want to put on your roof and everything. And compared to that, just planting a little tree has less impact. So that's a kind of negative impact that you can have from those green roofs. So that would not be my first choice, but nonetheless, they are useful, they are effective, and they bring greenery to the city. So if you're in a downtown area, you're building something new, is going to be a very marginal negative impact compared to the rest of the building you're developing, and in the long term would probably be positive. But so it depends on each and every project. But in general, what I presented was that if you're working on existing buildings in a densely inhabited area like a northern big city, North America big city, it's more likely to be more negative if you go to green roofs instead of high albedo membranes. And down the way to the other option.
But I think that's very interesting because really when I've talked to, with people about these benefits of urban vegetation, I think I mentioned it in the presentation, we're often talking about sort of a suite of known health impacts related to vegetation in urban areas, be it aeroallergen production, asthma exacerbation, that type of thing. But also property losses, damages from falling trees or breaking trees or just people trying to keep trees longer, maybe because of incentive programs than they should. That type of injury, those claims, I don't think are very well understood. This is the first time I've heard about the sort of life cycle assessment of what's required to actually build or even maintain an intensive green roof. So I think all of this is very necessary to sort of really accurately represent the sort of cost and benefit of these strategies. As I mentioned in the presentation, I think that's what's needed to really make the strong case and a convincing case to public and private partners that are going to be influential in sort of transforming urban areas into greener, cooler places. They are going to want sort of comprehensive assessments of both the ills and the wins for their local neighborhood, the block, and the metropolitan area. So I think it's great that someone is doing that work and has thought about green roofs in such a comprehensive way.
Great. Thanks to both of you. So this is a question for all speakers. Can any of the presenters recommend model zoning ordinance provisions for increasing tree cover as a method for reducing the urban heat island effect?
One that I would talk about is one I mentioned that the work COOL was led by Dr. Brian Stone. He has a book called Cities in the Coming Climate. And there's a lot of examples in that book at the local level, and it goes from around the U.S., but also internationally. And I will say that in Atlanta, we have a particularly strong tree ordinance. And so that type of legislation is maybe not as important for increasing or adding new canopy, but very important for sort of protecting the canopy that you have, which is even cheaper. One thing that the ordinance does include is a recompense fund so that trees that are taken down the money that property owners pay into the city's fund for new trees is like a penalty for cutting down old trees. So in that way, it not only protects the existing vegetation, but also sort of provides a mechanism to feed into the production of new urban greenery.
Great. And Pierre or Victoria, do you have anything to add about recommended model zoning ordinance provisions?
Well, I'll just say I think I know of similar programs to what Jason mentioned. As far as zoning per se, I don't know of any off the top of my head, but there probably are some in the U.S. A lot of other places like Atlanta do have these ordinances with different aspects, as Jason mentioned.
Well, we're beginning to see one of the ordinances in this province is that for any new development, a part of the land is to be converted to parks on private land. I mean, so it varies between 10% and 30% of the land that needs to be conserved in parks. When it's not possible, well, the equivalent in terms of the value of the land is to be paid by the promoter to the municipality for part development. So it's at least between 10 and 30%.
Great. Thanks to everyone. And we're just about at time here, so I think we're going to wrap up the Q&A session. But as we mentioned, the questions that we weren't able to get to during this Q&A session, we will have the speaker's draft responses to and post the responses along with the other materials on EPA's website. So with that, I'm going to pass it back to Victoria to wrap up.
Thanks, Wendy. Thanks to all of the attendees, especially those that stayed on for the full hour and a half. I hope that you found this useful. And more importantly, I'd like to thank our expert speakers, Dr. Vargo and Dr. Goslin. Without your work in the field and on this, we wouldn't be able to do what we're doing at EPA, so it's great to know what you're doing and to collaborate. Please stay in touch with us, join our newsletters, or send me an email, look at our website. We always advertise the webcasts in all of those places, and we will continue to do some in the future. Please let us know also what other topics you'd like to hear about as far as heat islands or climate change at the local level. We're always looking for good feedback. And thanks to everyone. Have a good rest of your day.
That does conclude today's conference. You may now disconnect, and presenters, please remain on the line.